Colin is a serial entrepreneur. At the age of 16, he was on the streets of Mumbai, where he grew up, reselling coat hangers, building a business out of that. I said, I thought you started at 9. He said, no, I didn't start at 9. At 9, I was stealing coat hangers. but I was warned by him this morning, look, you're in a church, so you have to tell the truth. So we'll draw a veil over the other stories. He's the chairman of Guardian Bank, that is a banker to the poor in Mumbai, mostly the minority Christians there. And that model of Guardian Bank is now being used in Kenya, Uganda, and South Sudan. It's really exciting to see how Colin is being used internationally now. The Bridge Network as well is a microfinance organization that he has headed up for many years. I don't even know how many businesses he has started or is currently involved in. A taxi firm in Bangalore that allows the poor, through some very clever financing and depreciation of assets, eventually after, I think, 3 years, actually own their own taxi and to be their own business people. It's just inspiring what he gets involved in. So he speaks internationally. I really don't have much more I should say about him, but Colin has a passion for the poor. You get him talking about how people who seemingly do good for the poor really are doing exactly the opposite, and you'll touch a nerve of his passion. He's got a very sharp mind. We share a similar kind of humor between us, and he has a twinkle in his eye. So you're in for a real treat. Colin, come and bless us.
You can trust Nathan to put me in an embarrassing position right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Nathan. Next time I'm going to introduce you. My brothers and sisters, I can't tell you what a great pleasure it is to be here today. I have to thank the organizers, Mary Ellen, and the pastors, Tim, and everybody at the First Presbyterian Church here, to invite me and give me this opportunity to be among you. And I usually don't wear this suit, It's our Indian version of the tuxedo. We pull it out in special occasions. And this is a special occasion for me because I feel I'm among very special people. I've spoken at many, many forum all over the world, but I've never felt this welcome as I have here, right from the point of time that I arrived at the airport, Bob and Caroline Nelson picking me up, and then I'm staying in the home of another wonderful couple, Sherry and Brad Carson. Sherry's here somewhere. So they have made me feel at home, and I feel that homes and hearts have been opened out, and I've never felt like that before. So the least I could do is, in our culture, we respect the audience by dressing well in front of them. So I decided to wear this, though I haven't worn the complete outfit, which includes a pagri, that is a turban. That's our version of the Stetson, you see? We pull that out for special occasions, too. I didn't want to frighten you at my first time I'm here. Well, I've been struggling with the title of this conference, Consumption and Justice. I've been guilty of infringement on both. In my life, I've overconsumed and I have indulged in injustice, quite a lot of it. But I thought I will, rather than trying to tell you about consumption and justice, and I'm sure each and every one of you have your own little story about it, I thought I'll share my story and my journey through life. And I'd like to believe that what we all strive for is just consumption. And we may or may not be there yet. I know these things can diverge, but we are trying to converge them. And the journey and the story of my life has been this journey of convergence, of justice and consumption. So like Nathan said, I grew up in a small town outside Bombay. I've now moved to Bangalore, but I grew up in a small town outside Bombay. And in a very, very lower middle class Indian family. Now, lower middle class Indian family means you earn a very little. Our family vehicle for most of my life was a bicycle. And there was food on the table, but there was no luxuries. Like, for example, you know, we used to eat one egg every day in the morning. An egg was a luxury. And that egg used to be shared between me and my brother, because, and my parents wouldn't eat the egg because that was a luxury. So that was my first brush with consumption and justice. I didn't think that was very just at all, to have one egg among four people. So you can imagine the burning desire for me was not to be poor. I would do anything not to be poor. And, you know, in the early part of my life, I started a small bending wire hangers, doing small things, whatever I could do to earn money. And my business activities and, you know, in my entrepreneurial mind kept seeing opportunity around me, and I kept growing. And each time, each step, it was a slightly larger business with more turnover, more capital. And I was fortunate enough to race down that road of good fortune and plenty to reach a point in my life where I was very comfortable. I kept adjusting my goals. My goals kept getting bigger. My cars kept getting bigger. My houses kept getting bigger. And up to a point where I began to feel that this was not enough. I was consuming, and I don't think it was very just consumption at that time. It was a consumption that was based on trying to outdo myself, outdo my goals on what I thought was my what I needed to achieve. Like, I used to set silly goals for myself. Like, when I was 21 years old, I decided that I'll get married when I have $1 million, or I'm 27 years old. And I set that as a goal. The problem was, I made $1 million a year after that. So, but I had not found my wife. So I realized that these goals, they don't mean anything. They don't get you anywhere. Well, the journey had a lot of ups and downs. And one of these downs, there was one point in my life where I had a huge financial loss, and I lost some of the factories that I had in the Middle East. And it got me thinking, and I realized that there has to be a change. I have to look at life a little differently. Also, I thought I needed a better challenge than to just pitch myself into buying a more expensive car than the one I had. So I realized along that way, and Nathan told you that, is that I had some God-given gifts. You know, I've never been to business school. I'm an engineer by education. You know, my parents could support me. You know, the emphasis was not on luxuries but on education, and that's true for a lot of families in India. But financial understanding, finance, balance sheets, financial planning, it came naturally to me. So I thought maybe there's some value in that. So I began to explore how I could use this to maybe serve. So my first attempt was to meet my pastor and tell him, I would like to help people. I'd like to use this to help people. He said, and you know, there's this guy who wants to start a small business, and why don't you come and talk to him? So I said, sure, I'd like to. So he got these two people together. I mean, he told me, you know, come on, give me a time, 5 o'clock in the evening on a Friday, and, you know. At that point in time, that day, I was supposed to meet this guy in the evening, but I left home in the morning. And I stepped out of the house, And I don't know exactly what I was going to tell him or what I was going to do. I knew he wanted money. I knew he wanted to do this business of some kind. So I took a wad of money, you know, a packet of Indian currency. I mean, in India, small amounts of money make big packets. So it was a nice packet that I put into my jacket pocket, and I stepped out of my house. And I felt so good at that point. And I made a prayer, and I told God that I'd like to start every day of my life like this, with good intentions in my heart and a lot of money in my pocket. You know? And I have started every day of my life since then like that. He has never disappointed me. And I think that somewhere along the way, the two were connected, or two are connected. So now I'm very superstitious. I ensure that I always have good intentions because I like that packet of money and what it can do. Not for me, but for people around. So anyway, I met this guy, and he turned out to be a crook. And he was taking the pastor for a ride, and he was trying to take me for a ride. So I quickly got rid of him, and that packet of money came back safely. But I realized that there are a lot of people who needed this kind of advice. So I got involved with an organization that called the Bridge Foundation. It had just started, and these people were very keen to have me involved and get understand how to use business to overcome poverty. And I was intrigued by that because here I felt I was a living example of that. I'd used business to overcome my poverty. So could I help other people with this? And soon I was on the advisory board and then the trustee board, and finally I've been the managing trustee of the Bridge Foundation now for the past 15 years. And we have helped 145,000 people in South India start small businesses over the past 25 years. That one thing led to another, and I began to realize that you can actually use your business acumen, or whatever it is that God has blessed you with, to help other people, to actually to worship in His kingdom, not in the traditional sense. I this is my belief. I don't believe that God really wants you to tell Him how great He is, or how sweet He is, or how just He is. He knows that. I mean, He doesn't need me. What He needs us to do, and I think that's what He needs me to do, is to be His agent here on earth. I firmly believe that God has not created poverty. We have. Poverty is the legacy of thousands of years of man against man. It is a manifestation of man's greed. And it is a cumulative effect of that. And if today we have a huge unequal distribution of wealth and resources, it's a result of that. And a lot of people ask me, so why did God make poor people in the first place? And what is He doing about it now that they are poor people? I believe this is what He's doing about it. He's putting the will to change the situation into my heart, into your hearts. That's why you're here today. And I believe that's God working in us. And what does He use? What do we use? We use the skill, the talent that He gave us. And in my case, it was running a business. That's all I knew. That's all I know. So I've used that ever since to start businesses and of all kinds. The journey was at some point in time that, you know, as you keep doing things, and you know there's a cumulative effect of it, people get to know it, and wonderful things keep happening to you. Miracles keep happening, and there were a number of such miracles. They introduced me to you as the chairman of Guardian Bank. Now, this is a bank that I formed around 14 or 15 years ago in Bangalore. This bank is focused on promoting enterprise within the Christian community of Bangalore. Now, let me tell you about the Christian community in India. We are 2.5% of the population. And we are largely a community that has been converted from the very, very low class, low castes, the untouchables, the Dalits, largely have been converted for that, as a means out of that severe oppression of being born for no fault of yours as a low-caste human being in India. So the community is largely very, very poor, and it is not entrepreneurial in nature. Enterprise and business in India is polarized into different communities. You have whole communities of, like, you probably know about the Jewish community in America, who's very entrepreneurial in nature, control businesses in certain verticals. But in India, you have about 6 or 7 communities that actually control all the businesses. In fact, 80% of India's wealth is controlled by 500 families that belong to a religious minority, and they are not Hindu. Their religious minority is the Jain community. So I believe that, I felt that we have to do something for the Christian community. The Christian community of people who are poor. And there's another very interesting thing that happens in India. When a low-caste individual becomes a Christian, you know, the government of India has certain benefits for low-caste individuals, like Dalits get a preferential allocation of educational admission or jobs in the government and so on. But as soon as you convert to Christianity, you lose all of that. So the economic privileges are being directly linked to their religious orientation. And it's only for Christians. If you convert to something else, you don't lose it. It's only if you convert to Christianity. So we had to do something for the economic development of the Christian community. And that focus has been the Guardian Bank. So I'm a great rabble-rouser. I can, you know, get people to... So I got 2,700 people to contribute capital and told them about this vision. And 14 years ago, we formed the bank, which is runs as it's a cooperative in its legal structure and runs in the city of Bangalore, and it's been expanding and growing ever since. Since that day, what I've been doing is, and it's got its own trajectory of growth, which will take to be an all-India institution will take another 10 or 15 years as the capital builds up. Interestingly, this institution was formed without a single dollar of external funding, without a single dollar of donations. It was only the community that got together. And even now, it has a balance sheet of about 60 million Indian rupees. And it's all the money of the community that goes back and forth. And that's the great thing about a bank, you know, a good bank, a Christian bank, is that, you know, it's the point at which both haves and have-nots meet. It's the bridge between the two. This is, again, something I stumbled on. I had no idea, and I realized that, you know, this is a concept that can be replicated. So ever since that time, whenever I'm in any part of the world, I try to go and meet the Christian leadership in that point. When I was in Bangladesh or in Kenya or, you know, Uganda, Tanzania, Ghana, you name it, wherever I happen to be for whatever reason, including a holiday, I try to go and meet the local bishop, and I sit down there and tell them the Guardian Bank story, and hoping that I'd strike a chord somewhere. Most of the time, nothing happens. But sometimes, great things happen. Like in Bangladesh, the bishop stopped me mid-sentence, and he said, look, can you come back here tomorrow? And the next day when I went there, there was a very dapper-looking young man, not young, dapper-looking man sitting there. And he turned out to be the richest Christian businessman in that country. And he said, look, this guy's talking about a bank that he started, you know. And, you know, we got talking, and 6 years later, they started a bank. I just had to tell them about how it was done and inspire them. They could do it. And that's what I go around the world now doing, talking about Christian banking. And for those of you who are interested in this, there's going to be a seminar session later on, and I was told to choose some topics, and they told me I had to repeat that seminar session, and I hate repeating things. I can't repeat things. I can't remember what I said. So what I decided is we do two separate things. So at one seminar session, I want to talk about Christian banking and social enterprise. And at the other seminar session, I want to talk about servant leadership and management. So if you're interested in either of the two subjects, you're most welcome to come and listen to me if you haven't had enough of me at this point. I find that I lead a double life, a life of, by Indian standards, a wealthy individual, a businessman running many different kinds of businesses. And at the same time, I also sit on the boards of many social enterprises, many church organizations of various kinds. And I found that my time is divided between the two, and at sometimes those lines get blurred for various reasons. They get blurred in terms of time, they get blurred in terms of money, and they get blurred in terms of resources that move back and forth. So I've been experimenting with this whole concept of social enterprise. Can we actually do a for-profit activity with a very small, strong social impact, where there is a very strong social outcome of some change, whatever you want to direct it at. My first experiment with that was this taxi company that Nathan referred to about 8 years ago. We started this company. It's a for-profit company that helps people who are unemployed find a livelihood. We called it SPOT, which is an acronym for Self-Employment Program for Organized Transport. We started with 5 cabs, most of them put in by us, and today we have about 350 taxis, and it's a very fast-growing company, and it makes an embarrassing amount of profit. What it has proved to me is that you can actually do well by doing good if you plan it accordingly, and that's why, you know, I think the difficulties that Trade as One is facing right now in establishing itself in the market and what Nathan is doing is only temporary, because eventually Trade as One, I'm sure, is going to be a very, very large organization, probably having a shop like the one I just saw permanently established in every church in America. It's only a matter of time, and I hope Nathan sticks it in. Where is he? He sticks in there. There you are. So that's what I keep telling him. Just hang in there, because people are going to get it. Maybe they don't get it now, but they will eventually will. So you can, social enterprise is another thing that has been very, very close to my heart, and I feel that's the way to go. We all are consumers, and we all consume, and one person's consumption is another person's, you know, bonanza, because he sells you the product. So it's a very difficult you know, toss up to tell you that consumption is bad. You know, if we saw that film the other day, I don't know how many of you were there, and I saw this American home stacked with all these things, and you know, I'd be very happy with that if I was the guy supplying the things. But you know, consumption is not bad, consumption is not good. Consumption is just that, it's consumption. What is bad is irresponsible consumption. What is bad is if we harm ourselves by our consumption, like consuming out of debt. And it's not, I mean, you Americans can't take credit for that. It's unique to all cultures. It's everywhere. In fact, you can afford to do it, but in cultures like ours in India, where there are poor people, it is even more dangerous. It's even more difficult, because the per capita disposable income as a percentage of your total income is so large, you know, that if it is misplaced, if it is consumed and not saved or not put in to create an asset, can cause such tremendous damage. Like, for example, we have a social ill in the amount of money that people spend in getting married, in conducting their children's marriage. People go into debt for years to get married. In our bank, in Guardian Bank, we have banned all loans for marriage. I don't believe that anybody should go into debt to get their children married. Now, if you can afford to spend millions of dollars on getting married, that's fine. But there is no reason why you should go into debt on that kind of a thing. But it's a huge social issue, you know, and your egos come into place, and all those emotions that drive consumption. Keeping up with the Joneses, a sort of instant gratification, short-term gratification, all those things that you struggle with. This guy is also struggling with. You know, I was telling my friends here that I had an instance when this guy wanted a loan and he was very, very aggressive about it. And when he was refused in the bank, he demanded that he should see me. And he came into my office and he sat in front of me and he said that he pleaded with me, then he cried, then he threatened me. And finally, he pulled out a razor blade and he said, if you don't sanction my loan, I'll slash my wrists. You know, that was his level of emotional motivation or whatever it was that was motivating him to spend money. And he would have gone into debt for 9 or 10 years. And he says, that's fine. He said, but I have to have my daughter's wedding in this kind of way. He's an old man. Anyway, I told him to go outside and slash his wrists and not on my carpet. So, but consumption of any kind can drive you. And I think it's a personal issue. I don't think that Madison Avenue has anything to do with it, or maybe something to do with it, but nobody can force you to consume. It is a personal issue, and it is a global issue. So what we need to do is responsible consumption and a redirection of our need, of what we want to consume. And I think it is more important for us to consume our time on this earth, our time to try to give as much as we can. I think it's time, it is important for us to consume as much of knowledge as we can. I think it's important for us to consume each other's unhappiness, each other's suffering as much as we can. We should redirect our consumption to try to equalize this huge injustice that exists. It will be a continual struggle for everybody. It is a continuous struggle for me, and it will be a continuous struggle for you. And there is no easy way out, but it's a journey. And every day is a step in that journey, is a step towards that point of time where we will have a world in which everybody is happy. Everybody can look forward to life in the same way that we do. Happiness and poverty, I also believe, are not necessarily related. I've seen very, very happy people in very, very difficult social and economic circumstances. There's these beautiful pictures I see in your, again, a beautiful church. And if you look at the eyes, you look at all these pictures, they're all happy people. They may not be as wealthy as some of the people here in America, but they're all happy. And I go around America and I meet a lot of people, and I don't see a lot of happiness there. So these two things are not related. So where is it? What is the gap? And the gap, I feel, is in that inner journey that we are making. For me, my inner journey has been to redirect my effort to try to use what resources I have, what gifts that God has given me, to try to correct this disparity of poverty in India. And I've dedicated my life to that. You will have to find your own inner journey. And you will have to find your own equalization point. Thank you very much, friends.